to the Christmas renal cancer podcast for Your Amigos. I think it's the final one of the year. Brian's let me do the introduction. You might have noticed that I've been banned from doing the introductions because I'm so bad at them.
They're just long.
They're just long. Well, I'm trying to make this short. If you'd not interrupted, it would have been quicker. No wonder they're long. It's the interruptions of the problem. I mean, it's very hard doing this, Brian. It's very hard.
Please.
So we're joined by Christina Suarez from Bar Hebron. Christina, welcome. We're doing the renal cancer Christmas.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome here, of course. One of our fellow Your Amigos. Chris, I'm going to kick off, if I may. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. I'm going to start with the biggest issue, if I may, belzutifan, HIF-2-alpha transcription factor, a drug which we've all been looking forward to the results of. And we saw quite a lot of data this year, but perhaps the most important was the randomized phase 3 LITESPARK data, which was everolimus versus belzutifan in heavily pre-treated patients. What did you make of, what were the results of that trial, and how has it changed your practice?
So thank you for the question. Yes, I think it was the most important data presented during this year. So I like the drug. So as you mentioned, the LITESPARK-005 trial was presented at this ESMO, and it compared belzutifan versus everolimus in patients that had received an anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1 inhibitor and an anti-VEGF therapy. And the core primary endpoints were progression-free survival and overall survival. So the hazard ratio for PFS was 0.75, and it was statistically significant, although the median PFS was numerically the same, was 5.6 months. And in the current analysis, no benefit was demonstrated in overall survival. So we'll see the results with longer follow-up, although I think 84% of the events have already occurred at the presentation. So we'll see what happens with overall survival. So perhaps the results were not as impressive maybe as we expected. We expect, like, we were really waiting for these results for a long time. But for me,
okay, Chris, I'm going to stop you there. You said they're not as impressive as you expected. So what were you expecting? Let's hear what you were expecting, Chris. What would have been impressive? What would have been impressive for you?
I think if you see the numbers of the PFS, it's not dramatically different. But if you see the curves are very nice, how they separate. And the median, for me, what it's very nice is the median duration of response. So I would like to have seen an overall OS benefit, but I think anyway, it's a good drug with a new mechanism of action and with a very interesting median duration of response in the belzutifan arm, almost 20 months in a very pretreated population. So I like the drug. I think it's a good drug, but maybe it would be much easier to justify or to use it, or if we had OS.
One of the legends who we were able to bring on the show, one of the urology cancer legends who were never able to bring on the show, Martin Gore, who isn't with us anymore and was an enormous force in kidney cancer. And I was lucky enough to work with Martin. He was unlucky enough to work with me, as he told many people. But he described everolimus in unfavorable terms, which we're not allowed to broadcast on the show. Is he right? Is everolimus doing anything? Or is everolimus basically placebo?
I think... Brian, do you want to say something?
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that everolimus always does the same, 5 months. Like, you see the record trial, if you see the Meteor trial, if you see now the 005 trial, it's always around 5 months. So it's something better than placebo, because patients do not progress at first CT scan.
But not everyone progresses on the first scan, and the response rate was 3 or 4%. I mean, it was very low, the response rate.
I mean, I think everolimus actually performed reasonably well in this trial.
Yeah,
right. And 5.6. About what we would expect, right? It's not a wildly active drug. It was approved way back in the day compared to placebo,
yeah,
right? Which shows you the state of refractory kidney cancer. and it's a reasonable control. And I think really the take home for 005 is reinforcing that belzutifan is an active drug, not so much focusing on the everolimus comparator.
Yeah.
The response rate was in the low 20s, as it has been in previous trials. The PFS, of course, was much lower, but that's what you get in a large randomized trial versus a selected patient population in a single-arm trial with a time-to-event endpoint. So I think the results were exactly as I suspected, right? A PFS advantage, no OS advantage yet, although that could emerge late.
With hindsight, exactly where you expected.
Well, I said that before I knew the results.
Okay,
Thank you
Brian,
for
let
that
me
long
ask you
time.
a different question, if I may. You've got to pick one of the
Please.
three. Where does belzutifan end? Does it end in combinations? Does it end as a biomarker-driven drug? Or does it end in the adjuvant setting? Where does belzutifan end?
I think if I had to prioritize those as what I think it will end, I think it'll end up in combinations in earlier line.
I'm gonna write
And
this
obviously,
down.
there are doublets and triplets ongoing now that we'll see over the next year or two, I presume. I think I'd love to see it end up as a biomarker-based drug, but that's extremely challenging and takes a lot of work. And I'm not sure if that'll happen, although I'm 100% for it, you know. And then in the adjuvant setting, I don't know. I mean, I'm more skeptical that HIF will play a role in the adjuvant setting when we've seen limited effects of TKIs, unless somehow it augments the effect of pembro, and I'm not really aware of strong data that it will. But obviously that
Chris,
trial is ongoing, so we'll see.
same question for you, Chris. Where does belzutifan end? Does it end biomarker-driven therapy, combination therapy, or in the adjuvant setting?
Okay, so biomarker would be very, very nice, but we never succeed with this, so I don't want to be pessimistic, but I don't know if we are going to be able to select patients. It looks easier than with TKIs as it has a direct target, but I don't know. I would love to see that. But what I think is that because of the mechanism of action, it's going to be good in earlier stages and probably in combination.
Let's talk about
So,
combinations now then. Let's move straight on to Tony's cabozantinib plus belzutifan data. He showed
yes.
earlier in the disease response rates
Yeah.
in the 70%, much
70%.
higher than I remember
Yeah.
Brian
That was
predicting.
front line.
Yeah, much
No, no,
higher,
no, no, no.
much
Hold on,
higher than Brian.
Tom. Hold
And my
on. That was
recollection,
the front line data.
my
What did you
recollection,
say, Brian?
yeah,
What
it was
did you
much
I didn't say
lower. It
anything
was
in that
much
sense.
lower than that, much lower. All right. Chris, what do you think about that combination data? It's good, well tolerated, response in front line of 70%. That was high, I think. You know, had we gone back in the day before the discovery of immune checkpoint inhibitions and those combinations, you know, had
Yeah.
someone come up with a frontline combination of 70%, we'd have fallen off our chair trying to do a randomized phase three, wouldn't we?
Yeah. So yeah, that the thing is that now it's very difficult to justify using a combo without immunotherapy in first line. In the trial, I think it was 53% of patients of good prognosis in first line, or around 50, more than 50%. So I think it's a good combination in first line for favorable risk patients, maybe, based on the data we have with IO combinations. And in second line, the data in combination with cabozantinib, 31% of overall response rate is really good, and it looks a very well tolerated combination. So we'll see. Maybe in some countries they can use it just with this data, not in it's not my case, of course. So maybe when we see the data of the 011 trial in combination with lenvatinib, this can be a good combination in the sequence.
Describe the design of that
And
trial for me. What does that trial look like?
yeah, sorry. So the 11 trial compares lenvatinib plus belzutifan versus cabozantinib in patients that have progressed to immunotherapy. So I think it's the thing with, I don't know if you agree, but if something seems clear with belzutifan, is a very, very well tolerated drug. So the most frequent adverse event is anemia, but it's quite easy to handle. So I think that this is a promising trial for me. And another promising trial, I think Brian mentioned before, is a 12 trial that is in first line combination with belzutifan and belzutifan pembrolizumab lenvatinib. So I don't know. I think we are going to see some good data in combination.
Let's move on from belzutifan. I'm going to, Chris, you'll be aware that there's been and I don't want to spend too much time on this issue because we can do it for hours. We're going to spend literally 2 minutes. I'd like your opinion as a passive observer about the unedifying debate that's taking place in the frontline renal space between VEGF TKI, IO therapy, and IO therapy. That beautiful discussion that we've been having many times. Do you think there is there clarity about the best frontline therapy? And do you think that as time has gone by, we've learned anything new?
So you mean for all patients independently of the prognostic group?
Oh, please, let's not bring the prognostic group into it. Okay, let's start. Yeah, let's say the intermediate and poor risk patients. Let's not talk about good risk disease. As time has gone by, has the data changed and has it changed your opinion?
So not that much. So the thing is that I believe that patients such as those with rapidly progressive disease in whom an IO TKI should be administered because of their low rate of progression. In patients with sarcomatoid features, I think nivo-ipi would be the best option. But in most of intermediate and poor prognosis patients, the majority of them, we don't know how to choose between, or at least I don't know, maybe you know.
I don't
between
know.
IO or IO TKI. And either option is defensible, and you can advocate for either option. So,
okay, Chris, that's fine. I'm going to ask you to score each of the current combinations out of 10. I'm going to give them a mark out of 10. So, ipi nivo.
That's very difficult. I'm going to say in intermediate poor.
Yeah, in intermediate and poor, ipi nivo out of 10.
I'm going to say around 8 for everybody.
8 for everybody. Okay, great. So 8 for everybody. So good. So 8 for everybody. Okay, I love that. I would do the same. Chris, your sound is going in and out a tiny bit. You want to get slightly closer to the speaker. Chris, the next question is the IMDC classification. How many marks are you going to score that out of 10 as a predictive biomarker?
Oof. I think I would say 7. It's at the end of the day, it's the only thing we have.
we can use.
So, and it's good. It's quick.
Okay, 7. 7. I hear 7. Brian, how many are you scoring out of 10?
Oh, I was going to say 2 or 3. I don't. The question is predictive.
Yes, predictive.
Prognostic. I'll give it a 7
that,
or 8.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say. So, yeah, it's going to be. It's very clear. It's prognostic, but not predictive.
Yeah.
Okay, we move on. So those two topics obviously were exciting. We saw a new combination, a new VEGF TKI IO that came out of China. I know you were involved in some of the discussions around that combination, Brian. Does that change anything for you, or is that relevant? It looked very much like the AXI-Pembro data as I saw it.
Yeah, it looked a lot like the AXI-Pembro data as Astrid, the discussant, mentioned at ESMO. And I don't think that's surprising, right, because it's very similar. I think it just changes access, as many people have said, to Chinese patients who now have access to an IO TKI and maybe didn't before. Does it change the landscape? Does it change all what we've been debating for years and years? No, I don't think so. Because as you say, the data is very AXI-Pembro-like. So I think it's more of an access issue than a game-changing new data issue.
We saw some new drug data with a bispecific of CTLA-4-PD-1 from AstraZeneca. Mm-hmm. Martin Voss presented that at ESMO as an update of previous data from Laurence. Anything to say specifically about that combination or that single agent drug with a combination effect?
I think the jury's still out, right? Bispecifics are interesting. There's some theoretical advantages. The data looks really interesting. There's still some dose issues to sort out. So again, will it be a game changer, or is it just, you know, inhibiting the same targets in a different way and going to be additive? I'm not sure. I think we need to see more data. We need to see some combo data and ultimately, hopefully, some randomized data.
We also saw some nice data from the Italian group, which I thought was really nice. I know the numbers were small, and I know it was with avelumab and AXI, but they stopped the AXI at 6 months, and the median progression-free survival was only 4 months. Mm-hmm. Does that say it's 6 months is too early to stop the VEGF targeted therapy? Have we learned anything about the duration of therapy of either the PD-1 or the VEGF TKI in the last few months?
So, Brian or me?
You go, Chris, you go.
No, I really like that the trial, that Thai trial you mentioned. Like, so, I think it's interesting. We are increasingly wondering at what point should we stop therapy in first line? Because as everybody knows, in the CheckMate 214, the nivolumab was maintained until progression, and in the IO TKI studies, the TKI was maintained until progression. And we are in the clinics, we are seeing patients with very nice or complete responses or durable responses, and we don't know what to do with these patients. So, and we knew from the START trial, you know, perfectly the START trial, that TKI treatment break is something feasible. So I think the trial, it's like, it gives you kind of proof of concept that interrupting treatment is something feasible.
Do you think the progression-free survival in 4 months is safe? Or is that, I mean, for me, if I said to my patient...
I would say it's maybe too short.
So that put me off of stopping therapy. I think it depends.
Right? Because if somebody responds, presumably, although I don't think we were given the numbers, they respond to some lower tumor burden, right? At least 30% lower. So if that progression is 3 centimeters of disease to 3.9 centimeters of disease, or I guess 3.6, 20%, then you're not too worried about it, right? So I think it's a super important study. Number one, because it shows the feasibility of doing these studies.
Yes, I agree.
Right? We all think it's important, but actually doing the prospective study is hard work. So congrats to the Italian investigators. I kind of agree that maybe 6 months is a little short. You know, if I was going to design an induction regimen, it'd probably be longer than 6 months, but that might also depend on response, right? It's sort of at that point or shortly after the point of deepest response, which of course you don't know till you're there or past it. And so I think there's a lot of nuances here. And so I wouldn't just take that 4 months and say, oh, it's too short and we shouldn't do it. I think there was also a lot of detail I think we didn't see, you know, that's important in that presentation, like burden of disease. Yeah. And did people have symptomatic progression? Did somebody have CNS progression off treatment? You know, those are all would be super important clinically.
Yeah. And it looked like it was a very good prognosis group of patients, I think, in the trial.
So by design. So don't stop therapy in the first 6 months then. Is that fair?
No, not with this data, but we need, no. No, but the answer is for me, it's no.
Yeah, I think for me, that would be too early. I think for me, clinically, and this is just, you know, my anecdotes, is I need to be sort of around that 18-month mark, maybe two-year mark when you're stopping the IO anyway. Patients are in a nice, deep response. Then I start to have those discussions about, number one, is there a consolidative approach, i.e. nephrectomy or SBRT, to whatever's left behind? Does that make sense? And then number two, can we just start stopping, you know, drug or drugs? And unfortunately, we don't have prospective data to guide us, right? We have maybe some case series, but not even many of them. So it really is an area. If we're going to advance the field, this is an area we can do it, right? In addition to new
drugs. I've got two questions for the pair of you before we call it a day. Call it a year. That's what we're going to do. We're going to call it a year. question number one is, do we learn anything this year about biomarkers and kidney cancer? I love your silence.
The short, silence is deafening here.
Okay, we're going to move on.
I don't think we learned anything clinically.
The silence says everything.
We're going to move on.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got two more questions. Okay, just look, I know we've done papillary cancer and we've discussed it before. Is VEGF-TKI-IO now the standard of care, or is cabozantinib still a perfectly reasonable standard of care?
I think IO-TKI is the standard. Right. And again, we'll never have perfect data in papillary. We're doing a better job of trials in that space, but still not adequate. Right. We just still don't, and probably will never have very large randomized trials. So for my patients, even though it's less IO responsive, it's the only thing that's going to produce a really durable response. So I use IO TKI in pretty much everybody.
I've been invited to give a talk at ASCO GU around, but I don't know why. I'm thinking the least appropriate person.
Another Tom? Is there?
Well, I mean,
maybe your brother. Maybe they meant
my concern is I don't feel the same as everybody. I'm not sure we've done terribly well. It's going to be a car crash, I think. I'm really anxious about giving that talk. I think the first three slides are going to be difficult because I'm not sure we've done terribly well in papillary renal cancer, and I don't seem to agree with everybody else. So, Chris, is sunitinib and cabozantinib a standard of care in kidney cancer, papillary renal cancer still?
Yes, in my country, unfortunately, but it shouldn't.
But if you had everything available
it
to you.
It shouldn't. Yeah, okay. I think if I could use, I would use for sure nivolumab.
Let's stay on this topic very quickly. The WHO classifications just come out. It's completely changed non-clear cell kidney cancer. There are now 23 subsets. It's molecularly driven. Papillary type 2 doesn't exist anymore. They've only got one type of... The whole thing's different. Has this WHO new subclassification, which I'm sure most hospitals are not going to be able to use, is it helping us move the field forward, yes or no?
I mean, yes, of course, better classification, molecular classification moves it forward, but we need to have molecularly directed treatment.
Yeah.
Right? Like in lung cancer, that's really helped because they have drugs against those molecular targets. I haven't seen that, but I don't think we have the same armamentarium of molecularly targeted drugs, at least yet, in RCC.
I don't share that opinion. And again, it might be worth coming to my talk if you want to hear my opinion.
I'll catch the virtual after.
Okay, I've got one last question, I did promise. So we had a press release. We've got a significant overall survival signal for pembrolizumab in the adjuvant setting. I don't think we've ever seen a survival signal with any drugs in the adjuvant setting in kidney cancer, and actually survival signals for immune checkpoint inhibitors in the adjuvant setting are few and far between when you go into other tumor types. There are some in neoadjuvant, but not many in the adjuvant setting. We don't know the results. What are you two looking for to reinforce this as the standard of care? And what do the impact of the other negative trials, atezolizumab and ipi-nivo, how much shine does that take off your enthusiasm for adjuvant pembrolizumab?
Go ahead, Christina.
Okay, so I think that it's going to convince. I'm pretty convinced about using adjuvant pembro. Obviously, in some cases you have to discuss with the patients the benefit. But if it's positive for the ITT population, I think it's a very, very good news. It's really good news. And I would like to see the subgroup analysis, of course, but I think it's going to reinforce.
Which subgroups are you particularly interested in, Chris?
So yeah, the thing is, I'm interested in PT3 obviously, and in T2 as well, but at the end of the day, T3 was the majority of the population of the KEYNOTE-564 trial. So I guess it's going to be really positive, even in. So I don't know. And for me, it's a discussion we have had many times.
We seem to have lost Chris. Brian, why don't you take that on?
The year ended early.
Yes, why don't you take
on different reasons?
Oh, Chris.
Oh, we lost you for a second. I think just to add to that, I mean, it's obviously clearly important data. It's reinforcing for the DFS benefit we saw, as Christina said. We want to see subsets, but not overinterpret them. But the M1NED and the sarcomatoid and some other things, you know, I think it'd be good to see. I think, you know, you asked about the other negative trials.
Yes.
I don't know. It's kind of that balance between, you know, every trial sort of stands by itself, but any one trial is only an estimation of the truth. So you do have to consider other trials, but at the end of the day, the data is the data.
Yeah.
The data is a strong DFS signal.
Yeah,
it's a strong, you know, presumably a strong or at least statistically significant OS signal. And my guess is you're curing a fraction of patients who wouldn't have otherwise been cured, right? So it's clearly low volume micrometastatic disease. We know there's a subpopulation of kidney cancer susceptible to single agent pembro, right? We know that from
427,
right? And other data sets. So it's certainly believable, and I don't have an answer why the other trials didn't see that, especially ipi-nivo, right? That's the hardest one to explain, which is more established and presumably cures more patients than single agent pembro. So that's
good. My final question. So I'd like to know a Christmas beverage and a Christmas, your favorite Christmas beverage and your favorite Christmas food item. Brian, we'll start with you as always.
Jeez. My favorite Christmas food item is my mom makes these magic squares. They're like a dessert with like coconut in it, which I love. I'll see her soon. I'll get her to make you some. Favorite beverage?
Yes, there must be something out there.
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know that. Okay, fine. Chris, favorite Spanish Christmas food. What have you got?
So we have like some food like, it's especially Catalan, escudella, but I'm not a big fan of it. So I would say that. I don't know. It's very typical to eat lamb or something like that.
Lamb.
It's very okay. Good. I like. Yeah. We don't have a special Christmas beverage, but we drink wine every time.
Yeah, so. I think it's gin and tonic. Isn't
gin
it?
And tonic, yeah. I think is the right answer.
No, wine, better wine from Spain.
Wine.
So I would say wine, gin and tonic.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, for me, of course, Diet Coke is a and chocolate.
Diet Coke and Snickers.
Yeah, I think Diet Coke and Snickers is my favorite Christmas food and beverage, which is is a surprise. It's a surprise. It's been fabulous, Chris. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
Thanks as always.
Yeah. Happy holidays. Happy New Year.
Happy Keep out Christmas. Trouble. Merry Christmas Bye. And Happy New Year. And see you soon, guys.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.